You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
I am the spirit of the future. I'm not supposed to, Molly, but I'm going to give you a glimpse of a day more wonderful than even you ever dreamed of.
Welcome to episode 192 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by Brian Eggert from Deep Focus Review to discuss a 1962 film that takes a look at how a family tries to survive when a nuclear weapon hits Los Angeles. Starring Ray Milland, Gene Hagen, and Frankie Avalon, directed by Ray Milland, it's Panic in Year Zero. But first...
The better you understand all of these facts, the better you will be prepared to discharge one of the greatest responsibilities of parenthood, the intelligent education of your child to the facts of...
The Forgotten Filmcast.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're happy to announce that we've installed Burns-O-Matic in-car heaters for your comfort and pleasure. When you receive your heater, you'll find it very easy to place in your car. Just roll down your front window and rest the heater's bracket on the window with the cylinder on the outside of the car. Roll up your window securely as far as it will go to hold the heater firmly in position. For maximum results, tilt the face of the heater towards the windshield and sit back and enjoy the show in healthful comfort. With these modern, safe, efficient in-car heaters, this drive-in theater will now remain open all year round. If you have any further questions about your Burns-O-Matic in-car heater, please contact one of our theater attendants. And remember, this drive-in theater will now remain open all year round, regardless of the weather.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
The terror shot that can't be stopped.
You're not God. You're not even human. You murdered those men, and you made me a murderer, too.
Weird experiments of accursed scientists turn human beings into living hybrid hell monsters. Now you hold hands with the devil. Now you run. Run for your life from the terror, the torment, the torture inflicted by Satan's ambassador of evil. The next victim could be you. Or you. Or you. Caught forever by the curse of the fly.
This hand points the way to an experience human eyes have never before seen.
Earlier this evening, I saw what looked like a small meteor drop into the desert not far from here.
You mean it could have been a spaceship?
Robert Clark is the scientist caught between vicious gangsters and the astounding she-monster. Here is a power that frightens the deer in the forest, terrifies fearless dogs. A woman so intriguing that her face and figure fascinate every man. The woman whose warmth consumes. But the astounding she-monster is no more to be feared than beasts of our own underworld.
In case you get any more cute ideas, that's an example of what you're doing.
You!
If you're not too afraid, make a date with the woman you'll never forget. A woman impervious to bullets.
And now, on with the show.
Terry, do you have to eat? Why can't we just keep going?
Because I've got to talk to somebody. They'll have a phone here. We can try calling again. Rick, Karen, see if you can get a container of coffee, will you?
Where's my eggs?
No more eggs. You're lucky you got your stack of sausages.
The menu says eggs.
I know, but we're out.
This joint stinks.
Oh, you're no bargain yourself. Harry, let's get out of here.
Look, there's a phone over there. Try and get your mother again, will you?
You got a match?
Yeah. You from L.A.?
Yeah, Chatsworth.
How was it?
You weren't there? Real bad. Blast woke me up. I went outside. First one hit Civic Center, I think. San Pedro, Long Beach Harbor went up about the same time. I hear the others were San Diego and Frisco.
I see. Yes, I see. No, thank you. I'll try later.
250 for stack and sausages?
That's what it says.
The menu says $1.10.
That was yesterday's menu. Report me to the Better Business Bureau.
86 on hand. We're out of white bread, too.
Well, that's my cue.
What cue?
Same thing happened to me down the road. And these little spots get used up pretty quick. People are poured out of L.A. like lava out of a volcano.
Yeah, the second exodus.
Now, take my advice and skip the next couple of towns so you can keep away from these.
Get through?
No.
Karen? Rick? No, he's waiting around here. Anne? We're going on the trip just as we planned.
The trip? Is that all you can think of?
I'm thinking of staying alive.
Harry, if you're trying to frighten me, you're wasting your time. I'm already frightened.
That's a safe way to be.
Rick, unlock the car. Look, sweetheart. Two and two doesn't make four anymore. At the moment, it adds up to exactly nothing.
For the next few weeks, survival is going to have to be on an individual basis. At the moment, we have to have food, a way to protect it and a way to get more when it's gone.
What do you want to do? Write off the rest of the world?
When civilization gets civilized again, I'll rejoin.
It's still here.
Ann, you said civilization was still here. Well, keep your eye on it. Watch it unwind to a small, hard core. Then someone's going to start putting it back together again. I want that someone to be us. Now, is that wrong? Is that immoral?
Okay, our movie this time is Panic in Year Zero from 1962. And joining me to discuss this film is Brian Eggert from Deep Focus Review. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back, Todd.
Always a pleasure. Why don't you take a moment here? Please remind everybody of who you are and what you do.
I'm largely, a text-based critic. I'm writing on deepfocusreview.com. You can find my reviews there or on Rotten Tomatoes as well. And occasional podcast guest. Otherwise, I have a Patreon as well that you can subscribe to if you like what I do.
The Rotten Tomatoes folks, you're legit. You know, the rest of us, we're just pretending. You're legit on there. On
right, right. Well, I was pretending up until about 2 years ago. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've been doing this for like 15 years or more at this point. So,
yeah.
I don't quite feel legit. I'm just a guy, writing in his basement, like a lot of us are.
Yep. Well, that's where I am right now, in the basement, surrounded by boxes and things that I keep telling my kids we need to get rid of, but it's just not happening. So that's the way it goes. So, yeah, I know on your site you cover a wide variety of different things, both new stuff that's in theaters right now and then older stuff as well. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, because you are someone that, is keeping current and giving your thoughts on the things that are out there in the theaters. Here we are in the middle of the summer movie season. Moving into August, that's when it starts to wind down a bit, but there's still some releases coming. But I wanted to kind of get your take on this summer, because I think for me, as someone who doesn't get to the theater as much, but I've really put in an effort to get to the theater more here, because this is the first summer in several years, given the COVID stuff and all that, that has really felt more like a legit summer movie season to me. Do you feel the same way?
I think, last summer was sort of like I guess a lot of people were saying that was like the return to the box office and with, Maverick and everything coming out. That being sort of the big movie last year, but there wasn't a ton of blockbusters like every weekend opening. I agree that, this week or this year has been, you've had a Guardians of the Galaxy, Indiana Jones, Mission Impossible, and then the whole, Barbie and Oppenheimer thing. And it's been kind of weird because all those big, IPs like Guardians of the Galaxy and Mission Impossible have done well, but not like outstanding. And now Barbie and Oppenheimer seem to be kind of closing out all that stuff, and which is great because I think those are really, director driven projects that are interesting, more interesting than the average, franchise movie. And then they don't have anything. There's not really anything huge coming in August. There's just some odd, the Meg 2 and a few other odds and ends that are coming out that are not going to, dethrone Barbie and Oppenheimer for any time soon. So hopefully that's sending a signal to the studios that, people want this sort of director-driven thing and to allow a little bit more personal vision in their blockbusters. Whereas things like Shazam 2 or The Flash are just kind of bombing. which, you know, hey, if that's the message that they take away from it, that's awesome. That's wishful thinking maybe on my part, though.
Well, I'm still down for all those wild blockbusters and such. It's been lots of fun. But it's been interesting, especially here in these last few weeks. I mean, as we're recording this episode, we're moving into the second weekend on the whole Barbie Oppenheimer thing. And yeah. I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, because I'm not expecting the Haunted Mansion to rule the box office this weekend, you know. I think one of those two films is still going to be number one. It'd be interesting to see if they switch places. I've kind of been wondering if that happens, because Barbie won out, but I'm thinking, well, all right, well, now all the people that went to Barbie went to only one last weekend. Are they going to do Oppenheimer this weekend?
Yeah,
I can tell you this. I don't have as much time to get to the theater. I've been, like I say, trying hard. I've seen a number of things this summer. I did see Barbie last weekend with my whole family, and we enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And I was just looking at, okay, can I get to Oppenheimer this weekend? And you know, I was looking at the Saturday shows, especially in the IMAX theater, and they're pretty much sold out already. This is a few days in advance, so I'm it's going to be interesting to see here what happens this weekend. It's going to be in the past as people are listening to this episode. You know what we don't know at this point, but right. It's interesting what's been going on this summer.
Yeah, I think, you know, normally in a normal summer too, what's unique about this one is the blockbusters are so long this year. Like Mission Impossible is almost 3 hours, and Indiana Jones even was 2.5 hours. And normally, you know, I liked both of those movies. And normally if I really liked a blockbuster, I would, you know, maybe 2 weeks later go and see it again. And I just haven't had the time because, frankly, they're, you know, you put in driving and sitting down at the movie with, you know, commercials and everything, and suddenly you're there for 4 hours. And it's just, I don't know. It's unfortunate. I didn't love Mission Impossible the way some other people did. I liked it, but I really wanted to give it another shot and see, you know, if I was just in a bad mood that day or something. but who has the time for this when? And the same thing with Oppenheimer. It's like that can't be on as many screens because it's 3 hours long. So maybe it won't do as good as Barbie because of that reason. And Barbie can be on more screens.
Well, yeah, and I mean, this trend towards the longer films. I mean, yeah, I've kind of been. I don't want to say frustrated about it, maybe somewhat. You know, if a movie holds my attention and it's 2.5-3 hours long, then great, it's no big deal to me. But it's oftentimes hard for me to squeeze in the opportunity to see a movie that length, like you say, even once it hits streaming or Blu-ray or whatever. I mean, I have not had the chance yet to watch Avatar: The Way of Water. I really want to see it, but you know, I didn't manage to get to the theater when it was out. It's on Disney Plus now, and you know, I could sit down and watch it anytime, but I'm going, you know, I don't want to watch it in two chunks. I'd like to watch it all at once. And do I have 3 hours right now or 3 hours that I can count on me not falling asleep in? No, you know, so I wake up early in the morning and go to work. So I have to plan my movie viewing around that kind of stuff. Yeah. And sometimes a totally 3 hour movie, it's not going to make it for me that night. So
yeah, and I don't want to sound like I'm down on long movies, because I'm definitely not. I love a long movie. But, you know, to your point, it's just an issue of logistics. I saw Avatar: The Way of Water in the theater, and it was at a press screening, and they made us watch it in 3D, and then also like the high frame rate, which I kind of despise. I really just don't like that effect. It doesn't work for me. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to watch it again because I'll probably like it more the second time because I'm not going to be so distracted by that effect. But who has 3.5 hours to rewatch Avatar 2?
Well, the 3D is a whole other thing for me. I usually avoid those if I can. I actually accidentally ended up in a 3D showing of Elemental a few weeks ago. I went in there and they handed me the glasses and I was like, oh, I didn't realize I did 3D. I don't typically do those because I have bad eyes. I've worn glasses since I was two years old, and I don't think my eyes register the 3D effect the way that it does for everybody else. And a lot of times it doesn't work as well for me. The picture seems darker for me. I'm the guy in Mallrats who's staring at that picture and he can't see the sailboat. I have never seen the sailboat, you know?
me too. In fact, I wear glasses too, and I have a thing where my eyes just take like a little bit longer to focus. Like when an image changes. And I think that's the reason that, you know, maybe it's a mental thing too, but I can't see those illusions. I never saw the sailboat or the schooner or whatever it was in Mallrats. And I've never loved 3D for that reason. It doesn't, yeah, it's too dark and it just doesn't work for me. And it's awkward to wear those glasses over glasses. And so not an ideal situation.
No, I agree. Well, let's get on with our movie here today from a studio that probably had its fair share of 3D movies back in the day, American International Pictures. This is Panic in Year Zero from 1962. This is directed by actor Ray Milland, who also stars in the film. When I sat down to watch this, I was like, oh, I didn't realize he directed it too. Oh, amazing. Of course, he had a long career in the movies, one of the highlights being his Oscar-winning performance in Billy Wilder's The Lost Weekend. But he did actually direct a few films. This is the fourth of five films that Milland was given the opportunity to direct. None of them are you know, really regarded as classics, but, you know, this wasn't like his only shot at directing. As I said, this is coming from AIP, American International Pictures, which means that we have the involvement behind the scenes of folks like producers Samuel Z. Arkoff and James Nicholson. AIP, of course, is the studio behind many wonderful genre films, monster movies, beach party movies, biker movies. Strangely, though, you don't know that this is an AIP film until the very end of the movie. In very unusual fashion for this era, there's no opening credits except for the title, and they don't run the credits or the studio logo or anything like that till the end. Though as I was watching, I was like, this feels like an AIP movie for sure. but the story here focuses on the Baldwin family, Harry, played by Ray Milland, his wife Anne, played by Gene Hagen, and their two kids, the world's oldest teenagers, Rick, played by Frankie Avalon, and Karen, played by Joan Freeman. Now, as the film opens, they are hopping into the car. They're going to be pulling a trailer up to the mountains for some camping, fishing, that type of thing. They're leaving at like 4 a.m, you know, because you got to beat the traffic when you're going out on vacation here. So the kids are moaning about having to get up early and all that kind of stuff. So they're leaving Los Angeles and, you know, they're heading up into the hills. And as they're kind of making their way up there, they're startled by a bright flash behind them. And it doesn't seem like lightning. There's no signs of a storm or anything like that. Strangely, when they try turning on the radio to learn more, you know, see what's going on, they can't get any stations. So gradually they start to realize that what is going on here is, of course, a nuclear attack. In fact, they see the mushroom cloud rising up in the distance. And so it becomes clear that LA has been hit by an atomic weapon in the first strike of the next world war. So the family first thinks they want to go home, which I'm sitting there going, that's a bad idea. But, you know, Anne is concerned about her mother back in L.A., but Harry soon realizes that this would be foolish, of course, and he then just goes into full-on survival mode. And, you know, cars are starting to flood the main roads. He decides that they're going to take a side road so they can go off into this small town where folks won't be raiding the supermarkets yet. And so they go to the store, stock up on supplies and such. They head over to a hardware store to get some other supplies. While they're at that hardware store, they run into some issues when they don't have enough cash to finish their purchase and they don't have the patience to wait for the mandatory amount of time to purchase a gun. And so Harry turns the gun on the store owner, committing his first crime in the name of survival. And, you know, of course, he promises he'll come back and pay the guy later, but, you know, whatever. So, but they head up into the hills. You know, they're going to go to the spot they were planning on fishing anyway. They go there. They destroy the bridge so that nobody else will be able to come where they are. They ditch the trailer. Then they set up home in a cave where they've got a pretty good thing going on. But unfortunately, it's a dangerous world out there, and you can't trust anybody. This includes a gang of young ruffians who come into the area, decide to settle nearby, and essentially have no problems with killing anyone that stands in their way. So yeah, we're dealing with a movie with doomsday themes to it, which I guess you know is kind of appropriate given, you know, Oppenheimer being out there and all that. But yeah. I don't know that this was on everybody's list to watch before seeing Oppenheimer, but I'm gonna let Brian start us out here. Give us a few of your thoughts on Panic in Year Zero.
Yeah, I think this, you know, I think it's kind of great coincidence that we're talking about this now a week after Oppenheimer opened. I think it's a movie that, you know, came out just a few months before the Cuban Missile Crisis. And everyone was worried about, you know, nuclear war, and, you know, everybody was learning about duck and cover and thinking that their own backyard was going to be, you know, tomorrow's front line. And this was very much in the consciousness of the culture at the time. And so this movie, despite being, you know, a B production from AIP, is hitting into the zeitgeist in a big way. It's not, was never going to be a huge blockbuster. Was never going to make a ton of money, just given who the distributor was. But I think it taps into something that, had it come out, you know, maybe in November after the Cuban Missile Crisis was over, it would have been regarded a little bit more as a little bit more timely, or maybe remembered a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But I love this movie. You know, it's rough around the edges, and it's definitely dated in a lot of ways, but it makes me think of that quote from Agent K in Men in Black, where he says that a person is smart, but people are dumb, panicky, dangerous animals, and you know it. I love this kind of story because I'm frankly really cynical about humanity lately, and probably always have been. But I think this movie kind of has balls. You know, this is a movie where Ray Milland is spouting about, like you said, goes into kind of survival mode and doomsday prepper mode, gathering all kinds of supplies that he can, you know, kind of is alerted to the first signs of our anarchy when he sees a guy punch a gas station attendant because he doesn't have enough money to pay the guy. And then 5 minutes later, he's doing literally the same thing when he's trying to load up on gas. And so I think it's got an interesting sense of morality that, yes, you're rooting for this family and the father who thinks it's smart to be afraid and thinks it's smart to do what he's doing, but he's also kind of losing himself along the way. And I think it could have gone, you know, this could have gone into like Cormac McCarthy's The Road territory. And I think if this movie were made today, it definitely would, just given, you know, how obsessed we are with post-apocalyptic fiction today. But I think this is really on the cusp of that. You know, it obviously wasn't the first post-apocalyptic story, and it certainly wasn't the last. But I think it's coming out at a moment where history and fiction are blending in a way that is really fascinating.
Yeah, I thought this was a fascinating film as well. I enjoyed it quite a bit. For me, first of all, you know, all you have to do is say AIP and I'm there, because yeah. I just find it to be one of the most intriguing studios out there. I mean, it, you know, I compare it to like how the people that grew up in the 80s, like I did, have a fascination with studios like Canon, you know, things like that. Yeah. It was just such a interesting crop of films coming out of AIP. And, you know, it's a studio that did so many films that were fun, and they were doing so much with so little. And here we have this film that definitely doesn't have that same sort of lighthearted playfulness that a lot of AIP films have. Yet it still has that kind of low budget charm to it, you know, and I think that goes a long way. This film, it grabbed me pretty quickly. I mean, it doesn't waste any time, you know, getting us to when the bomb goes off or anything like that. And from there, you know, the moments, you know, it's not like we have a lot of filler or anything like that. The movie keeps moving and had me interested. You know, maybe just a little bit. Kind of as the second act is winding down, maybe drags a little bit, but I thought it recovered pretty quickly and gives us a pretty solid finish. And I mean, just given the type of films that AIP was making, I mean, yes, this feels like an AIP film as you're watching it, but it's approaching this subject matter in a way that's so different from anything else. I mean, you know, AIP dealing with atomic age type of stuff. I mean, that's like the Amazing Colossal Man or something like that. Right. You know, that's a thing where a guy gets exposed to radiation because of the atomic tests and things like that. And he grows to giant size and all that. I mean, that's what you expect when you hear atomic age and AIP. This is not that at all. This is, you know, a legit kind of, you know, drama addressing some issues of the day. And I mean, if anything is to be considered a monster in this movie, it's more a look at how will we become the monsters in a situation like this.
Yeah, absolutely. The writer or one of the co-writers, Jay Sims, he wrote The Giant Gila Monster, which, if memory serves, was an atomic monster movie. And then also The Killer Shrews, which I can't remember what set the shrews off in that movie, but maybe it was atomic, like atomic, you know, radiation or something like that that set them off. But yeah, you're right. There's no the monster is humanity, and that's fascinating, and it's very un AIP like, as you noted. And that's kind of what I love. I mean, I love those movies, those atomic monster movies, and I love their science fiction. Especially with like Ray Milland. I mean, he made Premature Burial and
X, the Man with X-Ray Eyes. Yeah,
just such a great movie, and those are really out there. And this one just feels so grounded and actually like taking a step toward realism, at least as far as AIP goes. You know, it's not too like expressively shot. It seems almost like kind of like docudrama-ish.
Yeah,
You're dealing with like these really, it's almost like a picaresque where you're, you know, going from one situation to another, and it's, you know, it's got this sort of episodic structure where, you know, you're going from the gas station to the hardware store to crossing the busy road, which is a great sequence where the dad like lights gasoline on fire to get other cars to stop so they can drive through.
It's one of the craziest scenes of the whole movie. That's really the moment where you're just kind of going, I don't know if I'm on this guy's team anymore. You know, I get that he's trying to protect his family and provide for his family and all that, but what he does just to get his vehicle out and onto the busy road, you're watching it going, I think you just killed a few people in the process here. You know, it's wild.
He has lots of speeches about like saving, preserving civilization and what, you know, will come back when civilization is returned or will be the foundation of civilization. But he keeps, you know, just betraying his own ideals at every turn and really jumping the gun at every turn. Like, it doesn't take long after the bomb goes off. It takes very little time for him to just radicalize.
Yeah. Yeah.
Completely go, you know, he's punching people. He's preaching about how civilization is going to crumble, and he's proven right ultimately but he's adding to the problem. I don't know if the movie ever like fully confronts the viewer with his behavior. He has some reflection in the end, like, you know, I looked for the worst in others and I found it in myself. That's one line that addresses that. But really, you know, in the end, he's our hero and we're not really questioning him a lot. If I have one criticism of the movie, it's that they could have addressed that a little bit better. But he's so compelling and so challenging as a lead that it's, you know, just fascinating from beginning to end to watch what he's doing and how he's like teaching his son to both like fear the gun, but I want you to use that gun if you have to, but I want you to hate it. It's not like he's going to teach his son to start like, you know, eating people in a month or anything like that. He's trying to hold on to his humanity, but he's struggling with it.
Yeah, the questioning of his behavior, you know, really is coming more in from the wife character. And, you know, there's some moments, you know, where she has, you know, like the, you know, I don't think I know you anymore. You know, right. She kind of realizes he's not the man that she thought he was or whatever. But I agree. I thought they could have done more with that. And you know, with just kind of his switch into this mode, it is very abrupt, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. You know, it's literally like, you know, the bomb goes off and you see mushroom cloud and something just instantly changes in him. And he's a completely other person, because before this, he's standing in the driveway and he's messing with his fishing rod, right, and all that. And he's ready to go on vacation. And now suddenly he's this, you know, radical survivalist type of guy, which I kind of wish that we had maybe. I don't know. I guess it would have felt more genuine to me if we had seen him kind of struggle a bit more and maybe fumble his way through, this getting into this survival mode and what he needs to do to protect his family. Because, again, he strikes me as he's this suburban guy. He's got a nice house. He's got a trailer, all this stuff. You know, he doesn't seem to me like someone's that is necessarily going to have all this knowledge tucked away in his mind, unless he like memorized the Boy Scout manual back when he was 12 or something like that. I don't know. But, you know, just suddenly all this knowledge comes out and he's like, we must do this and we must do this and we must do this. And there was a part of me that wanted to see him make mistakes more in terms of what he was, doing to just provide and set up shelter and all that kind of stuff. I was half expecting when they went to the cave that, you know, there was going to be a bear in there or something like that, right. You know, just to not have all his attempts work out quite so smoothly, I guess. And maybe part of that was projecting myself, because I'm going, if this was me, I'd be making mistakes left and right. I would not last very long.
Yeah, I mean, I would have trouble just decking someone for, you know, out of the blue. Like, the first time you punch someone is not an easy thing to do, I think. I wouldn't know, I guess. But I couldn't imagine myself just punching someone, even in a life and death situation, and feeling, like, so sure of myself as he was. And I think, you know, part of this is you watch this movie as an AIP product, and you know kind of the sensationalistic style that they usually take, so it seems more grounded, and at least with that kind of, you know, intertextual context, you're at least I'm looking at this as like, oh, this is very realistic compared to what they usually do. Any other movie, and it's, you know, you compare this to the average Hollywood movie, and oh, it's very sensational, and this is B movie stuff. And so, yeah, they're moving the plot along, and they're not really concerned about character realism in the same way that maybe Billy Wilder movie or, you know, William Wyler movie would be at the time. But for what it's doing, I think it's dealing with these issues pretty realistically for an AIP movie, and it's giving them more depth than I think the average AIP movie would.
Yeah, well, and I think there's definitely a realism to these characters. I could certainly relate with what Ray Milland is going through here. I guess I really, as the movie went on, was just continually kind of putting myself in his shoes and thinking, well, what would I do if this was me? And I found it interesting that, this film begins with them going off on vacation. Maybe I was focused on that because I just came back from my own vacation where I'm off with the family and all that. And I was thinking about it in terms of, here's, you know, they're going on vacation and disaster happens. And my brain, when I go out on vacation, I always say, as the dad, that I can never truly relax on vacation, because there's always the stuff that you've got to take care of. I'm driving the car and I'm dealing with all the different things. And plus, there's just something always in the back of my mind that, you know, what if something happens? What if we have a flat tire? What if we get lost? What if we, you know, lose our wallets or something? How am I going to take care of my family? How am I going to provide for my family? My brain is always moving that way because I'm a worrier and all that. So, you know, that's just the mode I'm in. So here, as he's kind of in this situation, which again is launched by them going on vacation and the ultimate disaster happens, I was just like going like, oh yeah, well, it's just like when I'm on vacation, I'm thinking, what would I do if this happened? What would I do if this happened? And so I guess I could certainly relate to just this idea that he feels like he has to do whatever it takes to protect his family, to provide for them, etc. Because, I mean, call it an outdated way of thinking or whatever, but just the way that I am, I always feel like if something were to go wrong, it's up to me. And so I could definitely relate to that in this character.
Yeah, yeah. I think this is, you know, there's a streak of this today with you know, doomsday preppers or gun hoarders or whatever, who are just like ultimately preparing for what, for the worst. But you know, as a, maybe a more relatable view of looking at this movie, with the recency of Oppenheimer in the back of my head, with all these news stories about just, you know, the earth trying to kill us with the weather, and just, you know, it's every other day it seems like World War III is trending. This movie has been, since I watched it for this podcast, I rewatched it for this podcast, has been stuck in my head, like, do I need to start, like, getting water? Like, do I need to get, like, canned food? Is this something that I need to do? Like, he, as morally, you know, corrupted that he was throughout the story, he protected his family, aside from maybe his daughter, obviously. But, you know, he you kind of admire him, and you're questioning his behavior. But, yeah, it's definitely relatable. And, you know, maybe that's something we should talk about as the treatment of women in this movie. I mean, it definitely conforms to, you know, kind of outmoded gender roles, and the women have very little to do. They are called, and I'm only calling them the women because the movie calls them the women. you know, the wife is just kind of a nag for much of the movie, which is unfortunate for Jean Hagen because she's such a good actress. But and then the daughter is, you know, ultimately just a rape victim.
Yeah. Well, and the daughter is almost just there because it's like, well, you know, we need to make it a family of four. Mom, right. Dad, girl, boy. You know what I mean? Yeah. In the early part of the film, I was going, all right, I see where the, you know, the mom, the dad, the son fit into the narrative here. The daughter just seemed completely unnecessary. I was like, why is she even here? As you've mentioned, there are things that come into play later in the film where you know, she plays a role. But yeah, I mean, even just, you know, Milan's character is so dismissive of the ladies. Yeah. You know, it's all about his son. You know, there's moments where, you know, they are doing various things and they've got to deal with a certain problem, and he just sends the wife and the daughter off to hide in the trailer. And it's just him and Frankie Avalon and the shotguns, you know, and that's the way they deal with the problems. And yeah, it was weird.
Yeah. You know, another thing, I actually, for kind of preparing for this, I watched, I don't know if you've ever seen Cornel Wilde's No Blade of Grass.
No.
From 1970. It's a very similar idea where just a group of some family members and mostly friends kind of head out into the British countryside after bombs go off, or actually not after bombs go off. It's a virus that spreads, I think. And it's very similar, like it hits all the same beats. And I found it odd because, and I bring it up because the scene where the daughter in Panic in Year Zero is getting, you know, it's alluded to that she gets raped by these two kind of hepcats who are staying at this country house, is set to such a jarringly inappropriate, like, music.
Mm-hmm.
Les Baxter, who did a lot of AIP scores, it's this really great jazzy score throughout it, and it's very punchy, and it's you know, gives the whole thing a little bit of an edge. But then there's this scene where she's getting kind of tossed around by these two guys, and it's disturbing because it's so incongruous with what's going on. And strangely enough, in this other movie, this No Blade of Grass, there's an almost identical scene with an almost identically inappropriate music. And watching these, like, almost back-to-back in the same day, it was just, like, an eerie coincidence. Like, I don't know if Cornel Wilde was borrowing from this or it was just, you know, just a coincidence. But what a weird choice in both movies to have kind of this almost thrilling music to this, to these really what are really disturbing scenes. You know, they don't show a lot in this film, but they show more in Cornel Wilde's film. But an odd comparison, and just a wildly, like, that's one scene that just absolutely doesn't work for me in this movie, largely because of the score that's put against it.
Yeah.
But that's maybe one of the only scenes that doesn't work for me.
Well, and you know, you talk about what they showed in the one movie, what they don't show in this movie. I mean, obviously, here we are. It's 1962. This is AIP. Right. They're not going to show certain things, but they definitely do what they can to let our imaginations go wild. And I would say, even more so, and this almost disturbed me more, was, you know, when we have Milland and Frankie Avalon go to this cottage where they're going to take care of these ruffians that are causing problems. And there they find out that these guys have killed the owners of the house, except for their teenage daughter.
Yeah.
And they go and they find her there in the bedroom, and she's on the bed and she's wearing a nightie, and she looks very bedraggled, you know, and our minds just go wild with what's been going on in this house. And, you know, I mean, again, the film has certainly some dark themes. I mean, we're dealing with nuclear war and such. But when we get into this moment of the film, I mean, it seems like just a really dark turn here with things. And in some ways, that whole thing with the ruffians almost feels a little tacked on. It's almost like to give a little more sensational aspect to the film. I don't know that I'm necessarily complaining about it, you know, because I was certainly drawn into it all. But it kind of goes a different direction than the kind of, you know, we're going to survive out in the woods however we can tone to the rest of the film.
Right. Yeah, it's a weird left turn that it takes. One line from that scene that really stuck with me is that as they're kind of creeping up on, as Milland and Avalon are creeping up on the house, and the two guys are in the house and they're just kind of cackling about what they've just done. They say something like, "That girl thought we wanted food." It's such a disturbing line. Like, and you can't believe that you're hearing this in a movie with I believe the production code was still in effect at this point, right? So it was pretty disturbing. And then, to your point, it does take kind of a left turn out of nowhere, and it feels like it's maybe not about survival at this point. And I wonder how, to what degree it's commenting on or meant or exploiting the fact that, like, teens are such a hot topic at this time, and teen gangs are, you know, the scourge of society, and, you know, between that and the Reds, like, America is falling apart. That was sort of the commentary at the time, but this is what's going to happen when the world ends, is that the teenagers are going to band together and form rape gangs, I guess.
Yeah. Well, let's dig in a bit to the performances here. I mean, you know, we've talked a lot about Ray Milland. I guess I want to address some of the other members of the cast, but before we do, you know, what's your opinion of what he's bringing here? And I guess not just Milland as an actor here, but I mean, he's the director. How's he handling things as a director, do you think?
I mean, I've read that Milland didn't really remember directing this. I guess, you know, they had such a short production schedule, and he was probably drunk most of the time. I think he was kind of a big alcoholic in the later part of his life.
The lost movie, huh?
Right. And so he said that he didn't remember directing this. Okay. You know, I think it's a very functional movie and very functionally shot. There's not much going on in terms of, like, shadows or, you know, expressive camera work or anything like that. Nothing really in terms of form to express much. You know, they're shooting on back lots. You know, they're shooting on, I think, the Republic Pictures back lot.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that, you know, like the neighborhood in the beginning where their home is the same neighborhood at the end where they, like, go to the doctor. It's just like, it's just messed up a little bit. And that just kind of comes with the territory. So I think Milland is doing what he can with what he's given and his resources, but I think he does a hell of a job, frankly. And I only noticed that stuff after watching it, maybe the second or third time because I'm so invested in what's going on, and everything is so, like, just so efficient and so visceral in terms of storytelling that and the performances that I don't think the rest of it matters at all.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's a film that as you watch it, I mean, there's no question this is a low budget production, but I think it's handled so well, and he's doing so much with the limited resources that he's got. You don't get caught up in, like, oh, that's clearly a paper mache cave,
right,
you know,
right.
Whatever, you know, it's like, you know, it none of that matters. And Milan delivers a very good performance, I would say. I mean, it's the centerpiece of the whole thing. I mean, there's really, I don't think too many moments of this film where he's not on screen. Right. He's the center of what's going on here. And he does a very good performance. Now, you know, I wondered, you know, when it comes to his direction, you know, I was like, all right, well, is his greatest achievement as a director here just putting all the focus on himself? I don't know. You know,
yeah.
I guess I want to give him more credit than that. But I mean, I guess the fact of the matter is that, as we kind of said, primarily with the female characters, there's not a whole lot for the other characters or the other actors to do in this film. I think Frankie Avalon certainly has some moments, and I was impressed and surprised by him because my impression of Frankie Avalon is primarily like the Beach Party films.
Yeah.
And this is still a year or so away from the first Beach Party movie. And, you know, I get why they would put more focus on him than some of the others, because he's an up and coming teen actor, teen in quotes. He's 22, I think, they make this, you know, so he's not a teenager, but I like what Frankie is doing here. I mean, it's, you know, again, I guess my vision of Frankie is mainly those Beach Party movies, that playful stuff. It's a little goofy and all that. And here I'm going, Frankie's a legit actor. It's not just silliness, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think Jean Hagen gets her moments too, when she's kind of wielding the gun and trying to protect her daughter, I think, and she kind of loses it. And granted, she's not like, well, let's go kill those guys or anything like that. She's still kind of reduced to this mother role. I think she does well in that part. She, you know, at the time, she's another one who was kind of lost to alcoholism, and I think she only made one more movie after this, Dead Ringer, with Betty Davis, but. But so she was like, you know, she was struggling and probably half in the bag as she was making this. But yeah, she's got a couple of good scenes. But, you know, this is Jean Hagen from Singing in the Rain, and she's so great in that. And
yeah.
I just, you know, wanted more for that, for her as an actress. But yeah, ultimately, I think you're right that this is kind of Milan's show, and he is very much center stage. And as good as Avalon can be in certain scenes, I don't think that he's ever the focus, really, mm-hmm. of any particular scene. He's always just, you know, there with Milan.
Maybe just the kind of the one moment where it's the kind of romantic scene between him and the teenage girl that they rescued from the house.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know, but yeah, otherwise, yeah, it's all about Milan.
And Milan is great. I think I've always liked him as just a presence. I think he really acts the hell out of The Lost Weekend, but a lot of other times I think he's just a fascinating presence. You know, he was in like Ministry of Fear and did some kind of humorous scenes in that. But really it's just, he's just kind of a commanding guy for the screen, you know. It's I just like watching him, and I don't think he changes a lot from role to role, but there's just something about him that looks good on screen. And
yeah,
he can play serious, he can play funny, and not that he gets to play funny a lot in this movie, but he sells every moment, and I never feel him acting because he's such a convincing performer.
Yeah, he's not your typical leading man, you know. He's got something really unique that is, you know, certainly compelling. And
right,
you know, I think that's the thing about him in so many roles, is that he's not the typical, you know, type of handsome guy that you expect to be at the forefront of your picture. But he's someone that is going to draw you in. And he does in so many diverse films. I mean, we've thrown out so many titles, from The Lost Weekend to The Man with X-Ray Eyes, things like that. You know, such a diverse filmography going on there, and yet always compelling.
Yeah, one I kind of want to mention because I really like this movie is Billy Wilder's directorial debut, The Major and the Minor, which is such an inappropriate idea today. It would never be made today, but it's a super funny movie from, I think it's like 1942. Have you seen this, Major and the Minor?
No, I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, he's in the military and he's taking a train ride. And Ginger Rogers is an adult who pretends to be like a minor to get a free ride and kind of falls for his character. But, you know, she's pretending to be a minor and he's sort of falling for her inappropriately and just kind of walking this line the way that only Billy Wilder could. It's such a weird comical performance that, you should check it out. It's really good.
Absolutely. Well, before we take it to the break here, let's just hit on the ending of the movie really quick. I guess just your thoughts. I mean, this is the type of story that I guess it's hard to wrap up and put a bow on, you know, just because we know it's not that easy. Yeah. If events like this were to happen, I guess, you know, do you think the ending works? You know, is it maybe a little too clean? What do you think?
I mean, viewing this through the lens of this is a movie that came out in 1962. Yeah, I think it's clean, but that's okay. It kind of goes with the territory. It's going to have kind of a happy ending. There's going to be hope at the end of the movie. It's not just it's not going to end in a way that's bleak. Then again, this is just a few years before Dr. Strangelove and Failsafe, and those movies have much bleaker endings. And they're dealing with the same material. So I think it probably could have, if anybody could have done it at this time, it would have been AIP. All of that said, the ending doesn't really bother me. It's not very realistic and it's overly hopeful for the, but it works. It works for me.
It's funny, because as I'm watching the ending, I mean, you're right. It's got this kind of hope to it. And I'm thinking, oh, well, yeah, we had to have a happy ending. But there's a part of me that also thought what they kind of lay the foundation for could have been the springboard for a more traditional AIP film, because they encounter the military and they talk about, oh, you're one of the good ones, you know, and they kind of talk about radiation sickness that, you know, people have had. And I'm thinking they could go back to Los Angeles and like encounter zombies or monsters or who knows what. This could be the springboard for something else that's much more in the traditional AIP vein.
Absolutely. That would be a really fascinating sequel had that ever been made. They just go full science fiction pretty soon they're fighting, you know, giant ants or something like that. That'd be fascinating.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break here. We'll hear from another LAMB Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
In a world where podcasts already seem to address every imaginable subject, one man broke new ground with a seemingly random obsession about exploding helicopters in movies. He was a podcaster on the edge, a maverick broadcaster who played by his own rules. Now, he has a last chance to talk about the strange way helicopters explode in film. Exploding Helicopter, available on iTunes and Podomatic now. Think you know about chopper fireballs? Think again.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd, just reminding you that you can now help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few bucks a month, you can support this show and earn access to a bunch of great bonus features, including a bunch of the older episodes of this show that are no longer available on the main podcast feed. Visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Street.
Okay, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where each of us gets to talk about another movie that we've enjoyed, something we want others to check out. It might be a forgotten film, might be an old classic, might be something new in the theaters or on streaming. The possibilities are endless. So, Brian, what is your recommendation?
I am recommending Christian Petzold's new film, A Fire, it's called. If you're familiar with Christian Petzold, he's a German filmmaker. He made Phoenix and Barbara and Transit. Very, very good filmmaker. I've liked literally everything I've seen by him. And his last few movies have been... are you familiar with him, Petzold?
No, I don't believe so.
Oh, okay, great. He's a great director to discover because every film is just as good as the last, and there's nothing, you'll never be disappointed. His latest is a little bit of a break from his usual stories. He often is like allegorizing German history and like the reunification and World War II in his films, usually through modern settings, sometimes in a historical context. But this one is completely different in the sense that it's about just some young people who are vacationing at a summer house. There's kind of a pretentious writer played by Thomas Schubert, who's going with his friend Felix, who's a photographer, and the summer house is owned by Felix's mom, and when they get there, they realize that his mother has rented out this house to a young woman, and they don't really see her at first, but they hear her at night because she's having sex with someone, and they can hear her through the walls. So there's this kind of awkward setup where they're sharing this house with this woman. Meanwhile, off in the distance, there are fires, forest fires 30 miles away. And all of this kind of builds, these relationship dynamics build, and this fire keeps building to kind of a weird allegory about how we're ignoring things that are important that are going on in our lives, and we're a little bit too self-centered. And it's just a really fascinating character study that has a number of great performances. Paula Beer is an actor who he's worked with several times at this point, who's just a weirdly enigmatic presence. The main guy played by Thomas Schubert is, I hate to say, a relatable character. He's reminded me of myself when I was in my 20s, just wearing all black and being very self-serious about whatever project I was working on. Goes to the beach in all black. And so some people may relate to that, maybe not. Kind of, you know, hard to love characters in some ways, but I think there's so much going on between them, and the dialogue is so layered, and kind of the simple setup becomes very complicated in short order, that it's a movie I was just constantly thinking about afterward. And I wouldn't say it's Christian Petzold's best movie, but it's definitely one of the more interesting movies in theaters right now.
Yeah, sounds really interesting. I admit this filmmaker is a blind spot for me. I was just taking a look and I was going, yeah, I don't think I've seen any of these films before. But you know what? As you were describing the setup and what it's all about, I was thinking, oh, here, just like the movie we talked about, you go on vacation and there's a disaster. Here it's a forest fire. You know,
absolutely. I'm telling you,
vacations
didn't even make that connection.
Are not relaxing at all sometimes. Yeah.
Great.
All right. Well, the movie that I am going to recommend, I started kind of thinking about the fact that Panic in Year Zero is a movie where it is directed by the star, you know, and it is an actor who, you know, he's directed some things, but we don't typically think of him primarily as a director. We think of Ray Milland as an actor, but he got the chance to direct a few films. So I started thinking about, all right, well, what's another film that I've really enjoyed recently that was an actor stepping into the realm of directing? So for my recommendation, I'm going to go to the year 2013, and the actor is Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and the movie is Don Jones. John, which I just watched a few months ago and really enjoyed. This is where Levitt plays a New Jersey guy. He's into working out, and he's all about his family and his church and his buddies and of course, women. He's always going out and picking up women. But he's also addicted to porn, which has an effect on his ability to have a realistic relationship with an actual woman, even when that woman is the gorgeous Scarlett Johansson and struggles through a relationship with her. So Levitt wrote and directed this, and I think the script is really well done. I mean, it's funny in the right spots. It's tender in the right spots. And I was really surprised by Joseph Gordon-Levitt in this one. I mean, I know he's done a lot of great performances, but I guess I didn't expect him to work as this Jersey Shore type of guy. But it really comes off well. And plus, I'm always like a little leery when Joseph Gordon-Levitt is doing what I always call silly voices. You know, I'm looking at you, Snowden. I'm looking at you, The Walk, you know, those type of movies.
Yeah.
But here I think he pulls it off really, really well. It's got a great cast beyond him. I like that Scarlett Johansson is in this. She's great. Julianne Moore plays an older woman that he gets involved with at one point in the film, and she's wonderful in this too. You know who is really amazing in this film? Tony Danza. Tony Danza plays his father, and he is just fantastic in this movie. And Glenn Headley, too. Glenn Headley plays his mom. She's also great in this. But this was just a random watch for me back a few months ago. I mean, a lot of times, I've always said the hardest part of my day every day is sitting down and figuring out what movie I'm going to watch each day. Yeah. And, you know, I just kind of go through and will randomly pull something up. And I randomly pulled up Don John one night and I was like, oh, I haven't watched that. Let's check that out. And I really, really enjoyed it. So another one where we have a actor moving into the realm of directing, and I think he pulls it off quite well.
Yeah, I haven't, you know, I saw that maybe like 6 months after it came out, when it first came out on, you know, Blu-ray or whatever. And I remember enjoying it, but I don't remember Julianne Moore being in it or Glenn Headley. And I think it's worth maybe revisiting. I remember liking it. I just don't remember much about it. So I'll have to check it out again.
Awesome. Well, Brian, I want to thank you for being on the show. Before I let you go here, please remind everybody of where they can find you and all your various projects.
So you can check me out on deepfocusreview.com. Otherwise, I'm on Twitter and Instagram and Letterboxd at Deep Focus Review. You can find my reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, as I mentioned. Otherwise, it's Patreon/ Deep Focus Review if you want to check out my Patreon. A lot of my, you know, as you mentioned before, I write about a lot of older movies. Those are like longer essays in a lot of cases where I do a lot of research and whatnot. So those are kind of exclusive to Patreon for the first 6 months if you want to keep up with those, and I do one a month of those. Check that stuff out.
All right, thanks again for being on the show, and I'll be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast. Well, everybody, that's going to do it for this episode of the Forgotten Filmcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you go over to forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com, you can find more reviews of Forgotten Films. You can also follow me on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. I welcome your questions, comments, and feedback about the show, so please email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And don't forget about our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn all about how you can help support this show. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, go watch some old movies. We'll see you again soon.
Nothing like eating under an open sky, even if it is radioactive.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.